We want to welcome our special guest here, the Reverend Dr. Mitri Raheb. And we've already received his wisdom and insight with his preaching in chapel today. Thank you so much for presenting faith as resistance. And I can't help adding that here in Hyde Park, the home of President Barack Obama, we are glad that you said, yes, we can. So Dr. Raheb's presentation today will be about his newest book, Faith in the Face of Empire, The Bible Through Palestinian Eyes. There will be a book signing following the presentation. Dr. Raheb is the senior pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem, Palestine. He's the president of Dar al-Kalima University College in Bethlehem, as well as president of the Diyar Consortium in Bethlehem and of the Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land. Additionally, Dr. Raheb is also the president and co-founder of Bright Stars of Bethlehem, an independent nonprofit organization in the U.S. that supports the health, education, cultural, and spiritual development of the people of the Middle East in order to promote peace and harmony in the region. There's a lot of presidential material here, so we want to cherish your time with us. And we at LSTC consider Dr. Raheb to be our close friend and partner. The World of the Bible Travel Seminar, we visit every year that we go, Dr. Barbara Rossini and myself. Each time we've traveled, we've enjoyed the hospitality of the International Center in Bethlehem, and we've learned a lot about who are the Palestinian Christians from Dr. Raheb, as well as learning about all of the services and wonderful work of the DR Consortium and other institutions. So our first trip there was in 2005, and our next one will be in 2015. So please come along and follow in the footsteps of Herod as well as Jesus. Now you've brought that to our attention. We'll have to visit the Herodian, too, now that we know that that is the mountain that was moved. We also want to acknowledge our common friend, Dr. Naveen Saris, who worked with the youth at Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church before coming to LSTC for her doctoral studies in Hebrew Scriptures. She graduated last year, 2013, so please greet Naveen when you see her, perhaps at the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary where she's earning her MDiv. Now, we look forward to hearing about Dr. Raheb's contextual interpretation of the Bible in his book, Faith in the Face of Empire. Dr. Raheb has described his book as a new reading of the Bible, as an expression of faith of the people of Palestine within the context of imperial domination. We look forward to hearing from you and to being in conversation with you. And please welcome me, join me in welcoming our speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther, for this introduction and for being such a faithful partners as LSTC. Really, it's always good to see you in Bethlehem. And I'm also glad that Naveen came here for her PhD. In fact, if you're looking back, there are five women that went to study theology in our church. All of them came out of Christmas Lutheran. And in fact, in June, we are publishing the first book about Palestinian female theologians. It's called When Rain Comes, When Rain Falls, it's called. So, yeah. So stay tuned for that. I know you are interested in this topic. And thank you for coming to have a full house. It's always great. People from Valparaiso even came here today, and many friends. But I could tell that I'm in a Lutheran setting because the first rows are empty. So please don't be afraid. Come closer. What I would like actually to do is maybe to give a 20-minute introduction about the background of the book. And hopefully we will have time to engage in a discussion and in dialogue. This book actually is very near to my heart for many reasons. Since 3 days, Amazon ranked Faith in the Face of Empire as number one bestseller in Christian Liberation Theology books.
Wow.
Which is, which was really great news. And at the same time, they ranked it also one of the best 10 bestsellers when it comes to Middle Eastern and international affairs. Which is interesting that it seems theologians and Christians are buying the book, but also people interested in the Middle East and in politics. And this is, I think it's exactly this what I wanted to achieve with the book, is that to bring both together. But this book is near to my heart because this is actually my 16th book that I published and edited. But I felt with all the last 15 books that actually I was previously dancing to the rhythm of 19th century European organ music. You know, I studied in Germany, had this German lens on, and thought, you know, if you want to be kosher, this is how you do theology. Now, with this book, I feel I have come to listen to the beat of Palestinian and to incorporate the Palestinian experience into theological writing. And I think this is really, for me, important. And the third reason why this book is important for me, because I think with all other books and even all other Palestinian theologians, until now, when we were doing theology, we were not questioning the prevailing narrative, but we were asking for justice. And in this book, this is not enough. In this book, I'm trying really to question the prevailing narrative. Because the problem is not that there is no justice, but the problem actually is in the narrative itself. What do I mean by that? I still remember an American older woman who visited us in Bethlehem, and she was telling me, and she was sincere, but she was telling me, you know, I really don't understand why are the Israeli doing this to you? To you meaning to the Palestinian people. I mean, because God asked them in the Old Testament to be nice to the strangers. You see, all the theology so far was actually nice to the strangers, asking justice, but not questioning the narrative. So I told this older lady, I told her, you know, that's exactly the question, because who is the stranger? I don't see myself being the stranger in that land, and I have no problem whatsoever to be nice to the Israeli. But you understand, that's exactly the narrative that I'm coming to question in this book. And it's a bit maybe for you a bit challenging, because this is not the way we were trained to look at this text. And so the background of the book was actually to take seriously that the Bible is a product of the Middle East. I think we know that theoretically, but even for me, it dawned on me only after visiting Japan for the third time. I spent there 10 days. And when these 10 days were over, when I boarded the plane to go back home, I was dying for two things. I wanted a piece of bread and a piece of meat, you know, like a fillet or cutlet or something. Because, you know, Japanese people, they just don't eat bread. It's not something that is common. And, you know, most of the food is fish and raw fish, etc. And it really, at that moment, it dawned on me, Jesus could not have been Japanese. I mean, otherwise he would not have said, I am the bread of the world. He really would have said, I am the rice of the world. So, really, the Bible is a product of that region. And not only that, I'm making the case in the book that actually the Bible could not have come out of any of the empires in the Middle East. It could not have been written in Persia. It could not have been written in Turkey. It could not have been written in Egypt. It only could have been written in Palestine. And so the Bible has nothing to do, believe me, with the Bible Belt. And it didn't originate there, and I have to add, thanks God, I mean. Because we will be really in trouble if that is, you know, where it came from. It is a product of Palestine, and what I'm saying actually is that if we look at the Bible, all of the Bible from Genesis 1 until Revelation 22 has to do with that land and with the geopolitics of that land. So this is the first book actually that starts a theological book with the geopolitics. And if we look at the geopolitics of Palestine, you know, you will realize that Palestine, this is little tiny country. We were discussing, you know, Jerusalem is only 5 miles away from Bethlehem. I mean, a country smaller than Long Island. But really surrounded by five major regional powers. These are Persia in the northeast, Mesopotamia, that's Iraq and Syria. Then you have Turkey, you have Europe, you have Egypt. And if you look at the history of Palestine, basically those powers were more or less alternating who is occupying Palestine. And so it is very important actually to notice that our country has been occupied almost continuously for the last 3,000 years. So, I have a Presbyterian pastor who is a friend, and he was telling me, you know, he would like to bring his church to visit the Holy Land. But few members are a bit concerned, so he gathered the church elders, and they spoke about it, and they decided to organize a trip once peace is realized. I told them, you know, you are telling me you are not coming at all. You know, because unfortunately for the last 3,000 years, we have been living under imperial domination, one after the other. It started all with the Assyrians, 722. I think as students of theology, you know all of these dates. Then came the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greek, then the Romans, then the Arabs. For theologians, we end usually with the Romans. We think that's the end of history, but it's really not, because our history continued. Then the Crusaders, you know, then few others, then the Ottomans, then the British, and then the Israeli. Now you see, we never actually put the Israeli as part of these empires, because subconsciously or sometimes consciously we were connecting the Israeli of today with the Israelites of the Bible, and that makes a big difference actually. And I think this is exactly the disconnect I'm dealing it, with it in this book, is that, I mean, if you talk to political scientists, for them it's very clear. The project called Israel is part of 19th century European colonial history. I mean, there is no question about it. If you look from a human rights perspective and international rights, Israel is an occupying force. No question about that. It's only if you come with the Bible, suddenly things are mixed up, and the Israeli, they become in connection with the Israelites of the Bible. But what does that really mean? It means if we are to put the Israeli are part of the occupying forces in Palestine, then it is the Palestinians today who share almost the same experience like the Israelites of the Bible. And so listening to the Palestinian story today might be a very important hermeneutical key in understanding what the Bible actually is talking about. So that's the thesis that I'm trying to put here, which is really, it's really challenges the prevailing narrative. So now, thanks God that, you know, when I went to Yale Divinity School 2 years ago to write the book, first I was really thinking of writing a book in hermeneutics for theology professors. I thought, you know, this should be a book, you know, taught in hermeneutics. And if you see the first two chapters, you will still feel that spirit. But then I decided, instead of doing something about hermeneutics, let me spell out what I'm saying in a way that an ordinary man and woman can really understand it. And so, starting the third chapter, you see actually there is a change a bit in the language. But in the second chapter, it was for me important to put also this book in context of modern theological writings. Because sometimes, you know, you would think, you know, I mean, this writer maybe is sane. I mean, this is not how we were trained to look at the Bible. But thank God, in the last 30 years or so, there has been some very interesting theological developments happening worldwide, which really I'm building on them, and they gave me the confidence that I'm not totally out of tune with this book. And it's interesting, it's all started with a Palestinian Arab Christian, a Protestant, at Columbia University. 1978, Edward Said wrote a book called Orientalism. In that book, actually, he wasn't talking about theology. He is a professor of literature, English literature. But he, in studying the English literature, he could depict a bias against Arabs and Muslims. If he were a theologian, he could have depicted the same bias in theological writings as well. And this actually started the whole movement of post-colonial theologians, which I personally benefited a lot from it, because it brought different views from the South to look at theological issues with different perspectives. But then actually it was followed, especially since 10 years or so, especially after the year 2000, there was a series of empire studies done by historians, by politicians, but also by theologians. And that was started actually when George W. Bush was in his second term, and the whole notion of the new American century was developed. And many theologians here, they got so scared because they felt this language is a language of empire. And so you had all of these books about Jesus and empire, etc., etc. So that also was happening. And in the last 5 years, a brand new project was started by Norwegian theologians and English, British theologians, called Jesus and Cultural Complexity. It's a very, very interesting project, because they have nothing to do with Palestine, actually, these professors, because they were interested in nationalism and the relationship between theology and nationalism. And what they are saying actually is that lots of our talks, for example, the Jewishness of Jesus, has less to do with theology and more to do with European nationalism of the 19th century. It's a very interesting project that they are working on. It's not yet over, but it's good to see that there are some other people working along the lines. And this is, I would put it, part of this whole movement. So now let me come maybe to the last part. I started with geopolitics, with these empires that control life in Palestine, but this imperial reality is of utmost theological importance. Why? Because if you live always under the rule of the empire and you are crushed by the empires, the question of God rises up. In the sense, you start asking God, where are you? I still remember once crossing the checkpoint from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, and those of you who did that, you know, you have to go through these turnstiles, and there are four of them, but usually only one is working. And even at that day, that one was not working because most probably the Israeli soldiers was busy texting his girlfriend. So, and then there was this Palestinian woman with her dress standing there for 1 hour. She wanted to go to visit somebody in the hospital or so. And then after 1 hour, she got really angry and she looked at heaven, into heaven, up to heaven, and said in Arabic, "Wainak ya Allah, God, where are you?" You know, if you are humiliated by the empire, if your life is being interrupted over and over again by the empire, if you feel that the international community is abandoning you because no one would dare to challenge the empire, you start asking yourself, God, where are you? And the discovery that our forefathers and foremothers did was not that there is a God. This is boring, actually. And not that there is one God, totally uninteresting. But what was really important is that our forefathers and foremothers were able to spot God where no one else was able to spot him. Because God was very visible in the empire. You know, you go to Egypt, you see the pyramids, wow, it's there, you know. If you went to Iraq before the war and you see all of these big shrines, you know, they talk about, you know, how victorious actually that God is. But if you come to Palestine, the God of the people of Palestine seems to be so powerless. You know, he sees his people being driven out of the country, does nothing about it. By the way, his people were driven out of the country 587 BC, right? We know all of this story, how important that is. But his people were also driven out of their country 1948 by the empire. And if you really want to understand what 1948 means in the psyche of the Palestinian people, you have to understand what 587 BC meant for the Jews of the Old Testament. And it's actually the same story being repeated over and over again. And so God seems to do nothing about it. You know, he sees just his... Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is burned down. God does nothing. He seems to be either have given up or so powerless, like his people. And this is why actually the climax in the New Testament could not have been anything else but the cross. God, that's the ultimate actually, God sharing the same destiny with his people, being crushed by the empire on the cross. And actually he himself crying out, my God, why did you forsake me? But the discovery that our forefathers and foremothers did, what we call theologically revelation, was that God was there where they didn't expect him. So when they were kicked out of the country, God packed his luggage and went with them. And when Jerusalem was destroyed, he was there in the middle of the rubble. And when he was hanging on the cross crying out to heaven, God was at that moment closest to them like never before. Now this is a revelation, because it meant whatever big the victory of the empire could have been, it was never ever able to crush God, because God was with his people, sharing exactly their destiny. And this is why actually I chose this painting of Christ on the cross as the cover of this page, which has actually a very interesting history. Because this painting was done in the year 2002 by one of the top three Palestinian artists, and he happens to be a Muslim. And the story behind it is 2002, maybe you remember, that was the year when Israel invaded Bethlehem. And we were actually in the midst of all of that. We were put under curfew for 40 days, 24/7. We couldn't leave, we were stuck. And what to do when you are stuck? At that time I wrote my book, Bethlehem Besieged. But we wanted really to engage the larger community, and so we sent out an email to our teachers and students in the art program and said, you know, we would like you to think of paintings of Christ in the Palestinian context. Send us your paintings, you know, use this time under curfew to develop such paintings. And we received so many paintings. It was interesting that all Palestinian Muslim artists except one sent paintings of the crucifixion, which you think, you know, I mean, it's against their religion, it's against their dogmas. But when they sat under curfew, when they were alone thinking, what would be the one symbol that actually would best symbolizes their story, their narrative, their history, their experience, they could not come up with any better image than the crucified. Because this is actually what we have been going on, but this is also God in solidarity basically with us. And so this is why actually I chose this painting. Let me just say maybe a few more words. So if you understand this context and this setting, now you start to understand actually the message of Jesus in new light. Because when Jesus was going in Palestine from one village to the other, he was preaching the kingdom of God. And we cannot understand what the kingdom of God is unless we understand what empire is. Because the kingdom of God was a critique to the empire. And so actually the whole Bible actually is nothing but faith in the face of empire. So that's the thesis what I'm trying to show in this book. It's very challenging. If you don't want to be challenged, if you would like to continue to feel safe theologically, don't read it. But if you like to be challenged, and if you want to have maybe a fresh perspective, I think all the reviews so far were saying this is not repackaging of what this professor said or that professor said or that. It's really a new way because it's for the first time that we dare to look at the Bible with the eyes of the people of Palestine. But remember, that was the original setting of the Bible. So it might be very actually interesting. I hope it will be interesting to you. Thank you very much.